And welcome everyone. Welcome everyone. And as George said, it would be great for those of you who can have your camera on to turn your cameras on if possible. And I actually encourage all of us to even scroll through the pages a little bit. I think there's four pages of us here, at least on my screen. Depends on what Zoom format you have. But and just look around and connect with each other and get a sense of who's here. And I'm sure there are folks here from all over the world. And so practicing community is a wonderful, wonderful experience. And so just making a general effort to connect with each other in that way. So I'm going to invite us into just a few minutes of practice to kind of settle in. And then I will be offering a talk about practice. Then we will do a longer session of practice. And then we will have time for a Q&A dialogue about practice. Okay, so that's going to be the format. So let me adjust the sound so I can start us off here. Okay, and we'll begin with just a few minutes of practice. So inviting us to find a posture that for each of us feels relatively upright, uplifted, awake, and at the same time relaxed, sustainable. And of course, if for any reason of physical limitations you need to do that lying down or standing up or leaning against the back of a chair for support, that's fine. Please do what works for you. And if you are able to sit up in a relatively upright posture, that can be helpful. And then I invite us to bring our attention gently to the moment-to-moment experience that we call body. And in referencing body, I'm actually inviting our attention to the landscape of actual tactile physical sensations that make up the experience we call body. Body itself is just a word, a concept. There really is no such thing, but there is this moment-to-moment lived experience that we can feel, which includes all the physical sensations of touch arising and falling away on the surface of the skin from head to toe. And then also, very importantly, all the internal sensations throughout the body from head to toe. So I invite us to simply and gently direct our attention to feeling all the sensation we can feel externally and internally with an attitudinal posture of openness, curiosity, non-judgment, self-acceptance, and so on. And if we feel like our attention is still up in the head area, pretty much is where kind of most of us live our lives from, intentionally letting your attention drop down through the neck, shoulders, upper back, upper chest, down through the torso, through the waist, through the hips and buttocks and groin, down to the upper legs, knees, lower legs, and all the way to the soles of our feet and connecting with the earth below. And then as much as possible, relaxing into being. Relaxing into being. Simply allowing ourselves to be just as we are in the moment. No agenda, nothing to do, nowhere to go, nothing to prove, nothing to evaluate or compare. Just being. Just being. And within this quality of beingness, then a gentle intention to feel as deeply as we can, to feel into our sensate experience of being alive in what we call the body, including all of the tactile physical sensations we can notice and feel on the surface of the skin, and very importantly, within the body. So, in this sense, the posture is, the practice is simply sitting with an uplifted, relaxed posture, allowing ourselves to be and feeling whatever we're feeling. Being and feeling, feeling and being. Being and feeling, feeling and being. Being and feeling, feeling and being. And as we transition into the talk in a moment, I encourage us to, as much as possible, stay with this quality of being and feeling, feeling and being. Continually coming back to the body, back to presence, allowing ourselves to be as we are, to feel whatever we're feeling, and to have an intention to feel deeply with openness, curiosity, non-judgment, self-acceptance, and so on. Being and feeling, feeling and being. Thank you, and again, welcome. So, today I'm going to talk a bit about neurosomatic mindfulness, this deeply embodied, trauma-informed, a neuroscience-informed approach to classic mindfulness awareness meditation. I'm also going to talk about five neural networks that support healing and awakening, and how we can strengthen these neural networks through practice. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about an approach that I'm calling practice stacking, or body-mind practice stacking. And just a little background to that. I've been practicing meditation for more than 50 years, been teaching for about 45 years, And the deepest through line of all that is my practice and training in the Tibetan Vajrayana tradition, which I began in the early 1970s with my first teacher, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. And I've continued to practice and deepen and train and study in that tradition over more than 5 decades now, and I continue to work with my Tibetan teachers, and it's a core part of my practice. I've also trained, studied, and practiced deeply in the Zen tradition, in particular in the lineage of Meizumi Roshi, the Soto Zen lineage of Meizumi Roshi, and Bernie Glassman, who was my primary Zen teacher. And the lineage of Meizumi Roshi and Bernie has is primarily a Soto Zen lineage, but has Rinzai influence as well. So they do koan practice. I don't teach koans myself, but it is part of that tradition. And over the last 5 decades, I've really been a student of the art of meditation, and I've been studying widely across any tradition I've been able to find of any kind of inner work and contemplative work and meditative work. So I've really read deeply and studied in all the Buddhist traditions, and been to retreats and worked with teachers and practice a lot, especially in the Vipassana tradition, as we know it, the insight meditation tradition, and then in various Zen lineages and in Tibetan Buddhism. And then I've also studied quite deeply and practiced and been to retreats and worked with different practices in the Vedic traditions, the various Vedic traditions from India, the Abrahamic traditions, especially various forms of Christian meditation, and a little some exposure to Sufi contemplative practices. I worked with Taoist practices quite a bit. And for the last 30 years, I've been very fascinated with and studying neuroscience and ramping up all along, especially the last 2 decades and even more so the last decade. And I've also been very focused on embodiment and that kind of work for several decades now. And so I've been integrating all of this, and continually, and that integration is really represented in this neurosomatic mindfulness approach, and most recently in really working with a very targeted approach to strengthening these five neural networks that I'm going to speak about in a moment, and then this idea of practice stacking. It's kind of where my personal exploration of my teaching work has been evolving to. I just want to mention something while we're all here, before I go on, just a resource that I think would be of great interest to most of you, I would think, is a summit that we're offering this month called The Art of Meditation, and it will go live a week from Tuesday. So March 11th, it's an 8-day summit, and you have 24 hours free access to each day's presentations, which become available at 7 a.m. in the morning each morning. So 8 days beginning March 11th, free access to some of the most profound meditation teachers teaching today across all these different traditions. So day one is on Vipassana. Amazing teachers, Sharon Salzberg, Trudy Goodman, many, many others. Day two is on Zen, with some of the most prominent Zen teachers teaching today. Day three on Tibetan Vajrayana, with four Rinpoches, as well as Western teachers of Tibetan Vajrayana approaches to meditation. And then a day on Vedic traditions, with none other than Deepak Chopra, but also Swamiji and from the Art of Living Foundation, and many other wonderful teachers. A day on Abrahamic traditions, including Christian, Jewish, and Sufi approaches, as well as Michael Beckwith, who comes from a New Thought approach. And then a day on sort of secular approaches to non-dual meditation, direct realization meditation. H. Almas, Rupert Spira, many other, Amodama Ma. A day on the mainstream mindfulness movement, and with none other than Jon Kabat-Zinn and teachers of compassion meditation like Kristen Neff and others. And then finally, a day on neuroscience-informed approaches to meditation and the science of meditation itself. So 8 days altogether and completely free. So it's a fabulous resource, and I encourage you to check that out. And you'll find it at artofmeditationsummit.com, I believe. Artofmeditationsummit.com. Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to talk a bit about these five neural networks, and in describing them, I'll be describing how neurosomatic mindfulness helps strengthen them. And in describing that, I'll be kind of describing how neurosomatic mindfulness works. What's the logic behind this approach to practice? So the five neural networks are the attention network, the self-regulation network, the emotion regulation network, the task positive network, and the empathy connection network. And I'm going to describe each of those and how, in a very precise way, we can strengthen them through not only this neurosomatic mindfulness approach to meditation practice, but also other targeted practices. So the attention network is quite obviously related to mindfulness and awareness. One way to look at basic mindfulness practice is attention training. And so generally with any basic mindfulness practice, we have an object of mindfulness, something we choose to focus our attention on. And then because our mind likes to wander, generally what happens is the mind wanders. We notice that it's wandered and we gently and non-judgmentally bring it back. That's pretty much standard mindfulness practice. Very commonly, that object of mindfulness is the body and the breath. It can be really anything. We can work with anything, an external visual object, sound, other sense perceptions, smell, taste, visualized objects. We can work with thought itself. We can work with emotional energy. We can work with awareness itself. We can take anything as the object of mindfulness, the object of attention, although many of these other things are much harder to work with because working directly with thoughts, they're very sticky. We easily become distracted. Other sense perceptions are a little more ephemeral. One of the easiest to work with and the most grounding is the deeply felt physical experience of the body. And that's the approach I suggest with neurosomatic mindfulness. So we're training our attention network. And so we can actually have these neural networks in the brain. And these are neural networks that we know a lot about from current neuroscience and neuroimaging studies. And we know how they're interrelated. And there's a whole field called network neuroscience that talks about these and others. There are many other neural networks in the brain. And you could get very complex. And we could be talking about 14 or 21 neural networks. And but these are five primary ones, and I think enough. I think five is enough to focus on. And these five networks are very, very directly and obviously involved in healing and personal spiritual evolution, emotional spiritual maturity and growth, and also the possibilities for liberation and awakening. So the attention network is quite obvious, and obviously we need to strengthen our intention, attention, strengthen our attention to increase our capacity for focus and concentration and presence. That's kind of foundational to any kind of practice, any kind of body-mind practice, and really foundational to our lives and life skills and life performance altogether. And when I talk about strengthening these neural networks, what I'm saying is that they actually become more physically robust. You, neuroscience, doing MRI studies, would be able to measure changes in the neuronal thickness of the network. The network is actually increasing in its physical robustness, which means there's more neural connections, more dendrites, in some cases more neurons through neurogenesis. So it may be it going from maybe being a little kind of faint pathway, like when people start cutting the corner in a park somewhere and you see a little faint pathway where people are tamping down the grass, right? But as more and more people do it, the grass stops growing and get more of a dirt path. And then maybe the park says, well, we give up. We're just going to pave it over and create a new pathway there because people are going that way anyway. And then you have a nice, robust, well-lit pathway, right? So over time, the pathway becomes more and more robust through use, right? And we know the famous expression from the Canadian neuropsychologist Donald Hebb, neurons that fire together wire together. So when we associate activities and repeat them over time, which is what we call practice, we're developing stronger neural networks, more robust neural networks. And this is also how we move from a state that we're cultivating to a trait. So we may be cultivating states like openness, gratitude, forgiveness, mindfulness as a state, a temporary state. These are very temporary psychological, spiritual, emotional, cognitive states, right? They're temporary, they come and go. So, but if we cultivate a state again and again and again and again, it eventually becomes a trait, which means it's more how we are. Traits are more lasting, traits are more continuous, right? So, for example, if we wanted to become a person who was more grateful, we could take up a gratitude practice and have a gratitude journal and write our gratitude list every day and contemplate gratitude. If we do that every day, every time we do it, we'll probably feel grateful because we cultivated a state of gratitude, a state of feeling grateful. And that'll last for a few moments, perhaps, right? That's a state. But if we do it every day, sooner or later, we'll find that we're just more grateful. It just becomes the way we are, more and more grateful. So gratitude has moved from being a state to a trait. Same thing with mindfulness, awareness, presence, all these different qualities. And what that means is there's neural networks in the brain that have actually become more robust. So we just naturally go that way, right? We naturally go that way. So that's what we're talking about here. So that's the attention network. Then we have another very foundational network is the self-regulation network. And I really believe that adult development really begins with self-regulation because if we don't take ownership for self-regulation, then we're being regulated by everybody but us, right? So most of you are probably familiar with the autonomic nervous system, which operates and regulates almost all the body's systems, the incredible complexity of the human body. And this autonomic nervous system has two branches, the sympathetic branch, which upregulates, which we need for alertness, but then can go beyond alertness into stress and even into fight or flight and so forth. And then we have the downregulating parasympathetic branch, which is about relaxation, rest and digest, and so forth, recovery, right? And they're both happening all the time. And there's an appropriate balance for any activity, from responding to a crisis where we're going to have a lot of sympathetic activation, or just being in a state of readiness if we have a job where there are possibly some risks, or just, normal everyday working life, or our social life, or at home with family, or when we're wanting to go to sleep and have a good night's sleep, where we're going to want very little sympathetic activation and a lot of parasympathetic activation. So there's an appropriate balance for any human activity. And we can regulate that. And we can regulate it with the breath. And when we don't take responsibility and ownership for regulating our own autonomic nervous system, it's literally being regulated by everybody but us, the world around us. And that the interaction between what's going on in the world around us and our childhood conditioning, whatever that is. And, if our childhood conditioning was 100% benevolent and the world we're living in was 100% benevolent, then we could probably be in there in a relatively mechanical, mindless way and it might work out more or less okay. But that's not the situation for most of us. For most of us, our childhood was a mixed bag as best. Our parents did the best they could with what they knew and had, but still, for most of us, it was a mixed bag. And the world around us, even though I believe on some ultimate level is benevolent, on a relative level, it's certainly not. There's a lot going on, a lot of risk, and a lot of things going on, right? So we're in there kind of just getting shoved around unless we take responsibility to self-regulate. And fortunately, we can self-regulate using the breath because the in-breath activates the sympathetic branch. So when you breathe in, there's a slight upregulation of the sympathetic branch. The heart rate accelerates a little bit. When you breathe out, there's a activation of the parasympathetic branch, and the heart rate slows down a little bit, which is why with a healthy stress response, we have heart rate variability. Our heart rate, the rate of our heartbeat is actually going up and down like that. So we can use simple breath regulation tools like, well, just breath awareness to begin with helps, just being aware of our breath. Doing some deep breathing. Anytime we take a deep breath with awareness, let's all do that together now. Let's just take a very deep breath, filling up the belly and then the chest. And just let it out, perhaps with a sigh. Just doing that one time is like pressing the reset button on our nervous system. I think we can all feel that, right? And you can do things like straw breathing, which emphasizes the out breath, right? We breathe in perhaps a four count, out an eight count, or whatever count is comfortable for us, but the out breath twice as long as the in breath, usually breaving in through the nose, out through pursed lips, or literally through a straw. And that has all kinds of effects, which you can read about. Just look up in your search engine, straw breathing, all the blood chemistry changes and so forth. 4-7-8 breathing, where you just add a 7 second pause. So in 4, pause 7, out 8, right? Box breathing, where you have four parts, in, pause, out, pause, right? In, pause, out, pause, and the same count on all four. And various tools like these, simple, relatively simple and benevolent, not dangerous, breath regulation. There's all kinds of intense breath regulation. If you want to get into intense breath work, you need to get really good guidance, so make sure you're doing that safely and never do it around water. It can be very dangerous to be around water and do that. People can drown in shallow water doing breath work and passing out in shallow water. So, but these simple four techniques I'm talking about, the straw breathing, box breathing, 4-7-8 breathing, or alternate nostril breathing. Very simple breath regulation techniques that you can learn easily. They're actually all on my website, heartmind.co, heartmind.co. At the top, there's a tab for resources, and you go there, and there's video teachings on how to do straw breathing, box breathing, and 4-7-8 breathing. There's also a little short video on how to do a contemplative exercise called Safe, Resourced, and Connected, which is another self-regulation exercise. So self-regulation. Self-regulation is very much connected with emotion regulation. The emotion regulation network is its own network. Now, all these networks are interconnected in various ways, and they connect different and the same parts of the brain, and they're interconnected. So self-regulation and emotion regulation are distinct networks, but very interconnected. And when we regulate our own physiology, we're better able to regulate our own emotions, which doesn't mean suppressing them. It actually means we can really be in touch with our emotions, feel our emotions deeply, and not be hijacked by them. Not by hijacked by difficult, strong emotions like anger or upset and fear and anxiety, so, but also not getting hijacked by positive emotions. Well, you think, well, I'd love to get hijacked by positive emotions. Well, that's all well and good, yes, but if you experience emotional flooding, that's not a good time to make decisions. If you want to be flooded with positive emotions, that's fine. But if you're really flooded, you don't have a lot of access to the smart part of your brain. So it's not the best time to make decisions, right? Come back to a more balanced emotional state before you make decisions. But anyway, normally we're more worried about the so-called negative or challenging emotions, right? So when we're more in touch with our emotions on a regular basis, we're more in tune emotionally. We're much less likely to be hijacked because we sense what's going on before, when we get emotionally hijacked, it's usually because we're ignoring our emotional energy, and then it kind of breaks through and grabs us, right? And we're hijacked by strong emotions. So emotion regulation means we're deeply in touch with our emotions, but in a more balanced way. And therefore, we have access to all the wisdom of our emotions, the intelligence. So we're improving in emotion regulation, and we're also enhancing our emotional intelligence and gaining access to the wisdom. And all emotional energy, whether they're the seemingly positive or the seemingly negative or challenging, they all contain energy. Their essence they all contain energy, yes, but they all contain wisdom, and their essence is wisdom, which is very much about part of the Tibetan Bhajana approach with the five Buddha families that are also related to challenging emotions, and so forth. So, like, for example, the Vajra family has to do with mirror-like wisdom and clarity, but it also is connected with anger, right? And things like that. But there's wisdom and the possibilities for transformation in all emotional experience. So emotion regulation. Then I'd like to talk about the task positive network. And this is very important in terms of neurosomatic mindfulness. So the task positive network is activated when we direct our attention, when we direct our attention. Anytime we direct our attention, we're activating the task positive network. And that we could be directing our attention toward anything, right? And there's another network called the default mode network you may have heard about. And the default mode network is active when we do not direct our attention, when we just let the mind wander. And because of the negativity bias, where biologically, because job one for any species is survival, we pay more attention to threat than anything else. We have something called neuroception, where our nervous system is continually scanning the world for threats, right? And that's what we focus on, and that's what we take into long-term memory. And our long-term memory is full of that kind of experience, and then that creates implicit negative memory, and we start spinning everything to the negative, which explains a lot of what's going on in society, right? Actually, when things are neutral or positive, it doesn't even go into long-term memory unless we dwell on it and hold it in short-term memory, a different part of the brain, the science says, for 12 to 20 seconds, which is why my friend Dr. Rick Hansen talks about savoring the good. When things are good, spend time with it. So it makes that shift from short-term memory into long-term memory, starts to balance out our implicit memory, so our implicit memory is not so biased to the negative and to fear and danger and so forth. So at any rate, for most of us, when we just let the mind wander, it goes to the negative. It goes to worry. It goes to anxiety. In fact, there's some scientific articles and have been written and pretty popularized that talks about a wandering mind is an unhappy mind. Why? Because it tends to wander to the negative, to anxiety. A more mindful mind tends to be a happier mind. So now, the default mode network has its purpose, and if we can free it from fear and anxiety, it can be a tremendous source of creativity. And actually, most artists, in one way or another, visual artists, performing artists, all kinds of artists, are accessing the default mode network in a non-fear-based way. It becomes a tremendous source of creativity. Problem solvers as well, even scientists, and psychoanalysis, for example, if anybody's been involved in that or studied that, the idea of free association. Well, when we do free association, we need to be in a safe place. So it's the psychoanalyst's job to create a very safe environment for us so we can relax and be safe and then just let the mind wander and free associate. And it can be a tremendous source of creativity and uncovering different patterns going on in the unconscious and so forth. But for most of us, if we don't direct our attention, the default mode network is active. It's ruminating about the past. It's worrying and fantasizing about the future. It has a running commentary about the imagined present, which really isn't the present. It's forming all of our opinions. It's constantly reinforcing a sense of a separate self, all the selfing and so forth, thinking about me and what others think about me. It's a very noisy, busy part of our mind that when we first try to meditate, it makes it very difficult because the mind's racing. We have all these thoughts. And if we try to struggle with them directly, that doesn't work. The mind just reacts. It gets worse, right? So that's the default mode network. Well, the task positive network and the default mode network have a mutually inhibitory relationship to a degree. So when we activate the task positive network, the default mode network starts to go offline. So we don't have to struggle directly with the cognitive activity of our mind, with our thoughts. We just yoke our attention with something, and that creates a continuous activation of the task positive network, and the mind will start to quiet down naturally. We can just let it be. We can let thoughts come and go. We don't struggle with them at all. But if we really yoke our attention with something, we have this continual activation of the task positive network. The default mode network quiets down. The mind quiets down. Attention stabilizes. So the task positive network very much facilitates attention stabilization. And stabilized attention is the portal into deep states of awareness and deep states of flow, and really the most profound states of flow and awareness that in the Eastern traditions are called samadhi, right? So the most effective way I have found to activate the task positive network in a continual way is to develop a deeply felt awareness of the physicality of the body, inside and out. And especially inside, activating and cultivating much greater access to what's called interoception, which is a fancy word for internal perception, or interoceptive awareness. And there's a lot of neuroscience demonstrating that increased access to interoception increases our capacity for emotion regulation and increases people's scores in emotional intelligence, right? So embodiment, what a lot of people refer to as embodiment, being in your body, present with awareness and feeling the body, increases our capacity for self-regulation, for emotion regulation, emotional wisdom, emotional intelligence, and so forth. Another really important part of that is that any meditation practice begins with some kind of intentionality and some effort. If we don't have an intention and if we don't make some kind of effort, nothing's going to happen. The mind, the momentum of the wandering mind will just take over, right? So we're always making some intentional effort to begin with, and we're making an intentional effort to sort of self-regulate, to regulate our attention to begin with, right? Mind wanders, we bring it back. Mind wanders, we bring it back. So one of the real keys to getting access to deeper and deeper states of awareness and flow, which have tremendous potential for healing our nervous system, for healing trauma, and which then create possibilities for liberation and awakening and access to greater, deeper human wisdom altogether, is relaxation. Effortlessness. So, how do we get into relaxation and effortlessness with an effortful practice? It seems to be a bit of a conundrum. And it's a place where a lot of us get stuck for many years with our practice. Because we're developing the ability to be more present, be more mindful, but we're continually maintaining it with a kind of effortful, even if it's subtle, even a subtle kind of effortful monitoring, right? Of our own body, heart, mind, especially our cognitive activity and so forth, right? And that can be a barrier to really dropping in to the deep states that offer potential for profound healing and liberation. So we need to develop the neural architecture that knows how to practice on its own. We need to develop the internal neural architecture that on its own knows how to self-regulate into deep states of attention stabilization and thus then into deep states of awareness and flow. And our body, mind, heart system is a learning machine. It's one way to look at it. It's a biochemical, spiritual learning machine, but it still has those qualities. It's learning and it's continually changing. The phenomenon of neuroplasticity I was referencing before, that neurons that fire together, wire together, and we can completely reshape our neural architecture. So when we're practicing in a deeply embodied way with awareness, we're getting a lot of data. We're getting a lot of internal data. And anytime any shift in our technique, our method, our posture, anything, we're getting different data. There's a shift in the data. So there's an internal neurobiofeedback loop. Now, many of you are probably familiar with biofeedback, where you're attached to a heart monitor that has either a digital or an analog representation of your heart, the frequency of your heartbeat, right? And with that visual feedback loop, we can learn to regulate our own heartbeat with our mind. Just with our mind, we can regulate it up, regulate it down, right? We may be subtly doing something with the breath, but it's primarily the mind. So we learn to do that with that visual biofeedback loop. Now there's neurofeedback, where you're attached to a monitor that's monitoring your brainwave states. And you can also learn to regulate your brainwave states with your mind. And some of you may have done some of the, there's some simple versions like the heart math, the early heart math ones where you're looking at a computer and you have a galvanic skin response monitors, and just with your mind, you can relax and relax and relax till the color starts to fill in with all these colors and gets more complex. And so there's a lot of these tools. So and neurofeedback is used by therapists, and sophisticated neurofeedback machines are quite expensive, but there's a lot of potential there with neurofeedback. And then we have some simpler, people may have heard of Muse. Muse is a very simple neurofeedback tool used as an aid to meditation by people and so forth. Well, here we're creating an internal neurofeedback loop, neurobiofeedback loop, that where we don't need an external monitor because we're practicing, we're cultivating embodiment and presence and awareness, and we're getting a lot of internal data, and our body, mind, heart, brain, whole system connects the data and changes in data with other changes, and through that association, it's developing neural networks. It's learning how to self-regulate, and it's developing pathways that make it easier to move into mindfulness, into awareness, into attention stabilization, and then into deep states of awareness and deep states of flow. And so more and more, we're able to do that with less and less effort, and thus we're moving from effortful mindfulness awareness to effortless mindfulness and awareness. And this is really important for our practice to deepen. Right? So, attention networks, self-regulation, emotion regulation networks, the task positive network, which regulates the activity of the default mode network. And then in a moment, I'll talk about the empathy connection network. But just to give an example of the task positive network, I'm sure we've all, one time or another, tried to thread a needle, right? Or something similar, right? And so you have your thread, maybe you lick it a little bit to get a sharp point out, and then you're trying to thread it through that, the eye of the needle, right? And at least for a moment, your mind gets really quiet. Now, you may not be able to sustain that, but at least for a moment, your mind gets really quiet. Well, that's the shift, what you're experiencing. And I would encourage everyone to try that, later on, or something similar. And that shift that you'll notice is you're in your brain is a shift from an active default mode network to an active task positive network. The default mode network goes offline and quiets down. There's a lot of research into these days into psychedelic assisted psychotherapies and, some profound potentials for healing trauma. And one of the theories they have about the mechanisms of healing is that some of these psychedelic substances cause a suppression of the default mode network and thus give us access to a more holistic brain experience and profound transcendent experiences beyond self and all these kind of things. So there's a lot of research around the activity of the default mode network. But with embodied approaches to meditation, we can learn to activate the task positive network in a relatively continual way so that the mind gets very quiet and that we over time develop a quieter mind, a more spacious mind. Now, the empathy connection network is our ability to create connection with others, to create safety, intimacy, connection, positive relationship, relationality with others, right? Some of you may be familiar with polyvagal theory, Stephen Porges' work. And the idea of neuroception that I mentioned before, we're continually scanning the world around us for threat primarily. But with posture, vocal tone, other means, we can be communicating safety. We can have our own social engagement system online, to use polyvagal language, and that invites others to have their own social engagement system online. And then there's a possibility of approaching, there's a release of oxytocin and other neurotransmitters, and we're willing to connect with someone, to develop a positive relationality with someone, maybe even give somebody a hug or whatever, but have good flow, good communication. We've all had the experience of meeting someone, we somehow just naturally dropped into this beautiful flow of this beautiful conversation or something, right? And, we were co-regulating in a beautiful way there. So that's the idea of co-regulation. Well, we know from current neuroscience that many of the same neural networks that are involved in strengthening interoceptive awareness in self-regulation and embodiment are also involved in co-regulation and creating safety and connection and intimacy with others in an appropriate, safe way. Right? And so it turns out that the more embodied we are, the more readily we're able to connect with others in appropriate ways. Right? So strengthening these neural networks sets us up to have a greater capacity for effective co-regulation with others. Now, then we can practice that literally in our relationships. And I do a lot of workshops where we do a lot of presencing work in dyads and small groups, and we literally practice it. But you can be practicing it, just in your life. You can just work at being more present with the people in your life and listening more deeply and relaxing and just dropping in and really, the quality of time. Like, maybe we're all very busy, but if, or we're relating with one of our children or a spouse or something, we just get ourselves, okay, take a breath, and I'm just really just going to be fully present for them for the next 5 minutes. Right? And then I can go do whatever I need to do, but I'm just going to, instead of being semi-distracted while I'm there, we can practice really being there. If we do that, we're strengthening our empathy connection network. And doing this other work that I'm mentioning also strengthens our capacity to do that effectively. So, just about to wrap this up, and then we're going to do some practice. So imagine someone who's very attentive. They just seem really naturally very present. They're well regulated emotionally and physiologically all the time. They're very balanced. They're present. They're not, getting hijacked, and they're not getting upset about all kinds of things. They seem to have a lot of equanimity, a lot of poise, a lot of grace, well balanced. They're very present, right? They seem to have a very spacious mind. It's not they're, you don't get the sense they're busy thinking about somebody else. They're just like really available because they have a very spacious mind. When they need to think about stuff, they can think about stuff. But if they're not intensely thinking about stuff, the mind is basically fairly spacious and clear. And they're very naturally relational and available and actually really interested in the world and in you and others and so forth, What do we, a person that would show up in that way, in a really significantly way, that way, what do we call such a person? Well, we might think of that person as being relatively enlightened. Now, maybe there's, what we think of as full-blown enlightenment, awakenings, liberation, maybe requires some nonlinear tipping point that's beyond that. But this kind of work gets us pretty close and is probably the foundational work that would set the stage for some kind of deep opening or liberation or awakening and so forth, right? And we can approach these very directly. So we're going to do the neurosomatic mindfulness now, and I think you'll see how it's working with all of these. But then I'll just mention something else. We won't go into it much today. This idea of practice stacking. So I spend about 2.5 hours on my practice every morning and my self-care. And I start off with an hour of practice stacking where I'm experimenting with that all the time, integrating different practices in there and doing this one before that one, or changing the order and doing this one shorter, that one longer for about an hour. Then I go take my shower, and then I meet my wife in our meditation room, and where we do our Tibetan Vajrayana sadhana practices together. Now, that's another kind of practice stacking in a sense, because sadhana is a word that describes a kind of practice session, a group of practices that you do together. And it always involves some kind of basic sitting meditation, some mindfulness awareness meditation. It involves posture, it involves embodiment, it involves mantra, it involves visualization, it involves liturgical things that are kind of like affirmations in a sense. So it already involves all kinds of different things. So people of yogis have been figuring this out for a long time. And I do that in a very traditional way under the guidance and blessings of my teachers and the lineages I practice in. But this first hour I do, this is completely my thing that I'm cooking up and experimenting with all the time. And it includes all kinds of breath work. It includes posture work, embodiment work. I do EFT tapping as part of it. I have a whole gratitude practice. And I'm doing breath regulation for the whole hour in different ways as I'm doing different things like EFT tapping. I'm doing visualization, I'm doing affirmations, I'm doing forgiveness work, I'm doing gratitude work. And basically, I'm cultivating very, very positive states of mind such that at the end of that hour, I'm just like vibrating in openness and bliss and joy. And it's in a state of just profound gratitude and self-forgiveness and connection. And so I do that every morning for an hour. Well, over time, that's restructuring my brain to give me more access to these positive states. And it doesn't mean I'm repressing or not willing to experience anger or sadness or anything else, but I am developing a neural architecture that tends to, lean in a direction of feeling grateful and forgiving and open and caring and altruistic and compassionate and so forth, right? So that's this idea of practice stacking. And we have so much availability today to all the ancient yogic sciences from all the different traditions, East and West, and current neuroscience, positive psychology, quantum theory, it's all readily available. And we can just start mixing and matching and Experience. I think it's really great to practice within a tradition and with good guidance. I do that very much. But also on our own, we can also be experimenting with mixing and matching different body mind techniques and just see, well, okay, what does that produce? And if I do that one first, what does that create? And if I do this one longer, and we can just kind of work with ourselves. And I think we can accelerate the process of human development dramatically. In the old days, many of us probably would just go sit on the meditation cushion and just sit there, and something will happen. 20, 30 years, you'll feel better. Maybe you'll get enlightened, but not a lot more direction than that. I don't think it has to be that hard. I think with good instruction and really more precision, we can really accelerate and deepen our development much more readily and much more easily. So that's the logic behind everything I've been talking about. Okay, let's do some practice. So this is just going to be basic neurosomatic mindfulness practice, not the whole practice stacking phenomenon I just described, but basic NSM. So encourage us all to find a posture that for you feels relatively upright, uplifted, awake, and at the same time relaxed, sustainable. To begin with, I invite you to close your eyes if that's comfortable for you. I mostly practice with my eyes open, but to develop greater access to interoceptive awareness it can be very helpful to close our eyes at least to begin with. And if for any reason that's uncomfortable for you, at least lowering the gaze so there's less visual distraction. And again, I invite us to just sort of drop into the body. If our attention is kind of up in the head area because we're very visually and auditorily oriented and we have our busy minds and so forth, just letting your attention drop down through the neck, shoulders, upper back and chest, down through the torso, down to your waist and hips, buttocks, down through your upper legs, knees, lower legs, all the way to the soles of your feet and the earth below. And just sort of open to feeling the body, this inner outer landscape of tactile physical sensation that we call body. And it's very gentle. In fact, it's almost like we're just opening a door, and then this sensate field emerges into our awareness. And I'm emphasizing the distinction between body as a concept and the direct experience of sensation. My first teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche, made a distinction between what he called psychosomatic body, or the conceptual body, which is made up of thoughts and feelings about the body, memories, images, and so forth. And then what he called body, which was the actual direct experience of the sensate phenomena we call body. Body itself is just a word, and we actually have a conceptual body. In fact, there's a conceptual overlay on all of our experience, and moving into authentic presence and direct experience means that we're sort of dissolving that conceptual overlay or sort of penetrating beneath it, whatever image works for you. But there is a need to kind of break through the conceptual overlay into direct experience. It's just the way our brain works. It very quickly replaces direct experience with concepts because that economizes its energy. So feeling into the body ever more deeply, feeling the breath, feeling all the sensations related to what we call body. We may wish to begin with those on the surface of the skin, sensations arising at the contact points between our body and the chair or the cushion. Our feet and the ground. Feeling the contact between our skin and our clothing, the weight of our clothing, the texture. Sensations of warmth or coolness or the movement of the air where we are on exposed skin surface areas like the face, neck or hands, ankles. Sensations arising with the passage of air across the nostrils and or parted lips with each in-breath and out-breath. And as we continue, we could get a sense of that entire external landscape of sensation on the surface of the skin, from the crown of our head, feeling the hair on our scalp, to the soles of our feet, entire body, back, sides, front, that boundary between our body and the space surrounding us, space which we generally imagine to be empty, but is actually tangible, full of gases and so forth. And I invite us to regard that as benevolent and feel like the space is actually holding us and supporting us. So we're weaving through our awareness, we're sort of weaving together a womb-like structure of awareness and sensation, the external landscape of sensation. And within that, we can relax into its embrace and feel held and embraced and nurtured and safe, allowing us to relax further. And then I invite us to begin exploring the internal landscape of sensation. The overall weight and mass of the muscles and bones, the force of gravity holding us down on the earth. All the sensations that accompany the breath as we breathe in and out. The diaphragm muscle contracting and relaxing, the abdominal muscles, the intercostal muscles contracting and relaxing, rib cage opening and closing, flow of air, energy, oxygen throughout the body. Just that wave-like, continual wave-like motion of the breath flowing in and out of the body. Any sensations of discomfort or pain, being willing to just be curious about those, to feel those, explore those. And just the overall flow of dynamic energy in the body, aliveness, nervous energy, subtle life force energy, just the feeling of being alive, feeling that at a deeper and deeper level. As we relax further and further into embodiment in this way, this internal dimension, this internal somatic landscape becomes very vivid and compelling, and it will hold our awareness. We can rest our awareness there effortlessly, and we feel it's very, very powerful and dynamic, potent. There's a shimmering aliveness and brightness to it. Simply allowing ourselves just be as we are and feeling whatever we're feeling, primarily physically is the primary focus here. And it also includes everything we're feeling through the other sense perceptions and what we're feeling emotionally. Being and feeling and being. Relaxing further and further into being and feeling, feeling and being. And we won't go deeply into it now, but with neurosomatic mindfulness, at times we focus on the skeletal structure and our actual ability to feel that, to feel the skeletal structure supporting us. The entire body is a living organism, all containing neuronal cells, even the bones themselves, thus all sensory, all feeling. And we can refine and deepen our awareness such that we can feel into these things. The bones, the muscles, feeling the subtle kinetic energy or potential kinetic energy of the muscles at rest. Feeling all the activity and energetic vibrational quality of all the different organs, the lymphatic system, endocrine system, the glands. And as we relax further and further into feeling the body, feeling the sensate landscape we call body, all the internal systems, the vibrational qualities, the vibrational frequencies of all these internal systems, the breath, the brain, the heart, the glands, the organs, they begin to cohere, they begin to map onto each other, and we start to feel this palpable quality of flow, coherence, resonance. And again, we can rest our awareness there effortlessly and relax even further into pure presence, pure being, being and feeling, feeling and being, being and feeling, feeling and being. Being and feeling, feeling and being. Appreciating the miraculous aliveness of this incredibly mysterious and profound and miraculous experience we call being alive in a human body in this universe, on this planet. As much as possible, retaining this quality of deep embodiment, feeling the body all the way down to the bones and including the bones, feeling the dynamic aliveness of the body. Retaining that as best we can, I invite us to then gently open the eyes, look out into the world around us, wherever we are, and just appreciate the visual field from this place of deep embodiment. Appreciate the auditory field, whatever we're hearing. If we're aware of smells or odors, or if we're aware of taste, appreciating all that. Appreciating awareness itself, perception, the fact that we actually perceive. That we perceive this magical reality we call life, and this incredibly beautiful planet and the natural world, that just our faculty, the ability to perceive awareness itself, consciousness itself. all the great yogis and seers and sages have pointed to the reality that pure consciousness is inseparable from this very awareness, this very perception that we're all experiencing in this moment. And even when thoughts arise, their nature is also of that pure consciousness. And the movement of thought is just a ripple in the wave, in the flow of consciousness. And they've all told us again and again that what separates ordinary beings like ourselves from enlightened beings or illuminated or awake beings, it's just like a slightest, thinnest film, or the slightest, not even a hair's breadth, because it's right here, right now, that we're already awake. So just relaxing into that quality of appreciation, gratitude. And being here together, getting a sense of all of us here together on the Zoom call, zooming in from all around the world, being together. You might look around and connect with somebody online, share a smile with someone. You can have your camera on, maybe have your camera on, maybe scroll through the windows for a moment and connect with a few people, see their names, see their faces, give people a smile, make a connection. And then we could take a few questions. Any sharing, anything you'd like to share or ask about? Again, as George described, you can go down to the little heart down there where it says React, and you click on that, and you'll see hand raiser, and you can raise your hand, and therefore we'll be able to find you since there's four windows here. If you raise your hand, you'll come right up to the top window, upper left. Yes, like Charles Rubin just did. So welcome, Charles, and please unmute yourself.
Thank you. It's very, very interesting and puts a whole new dimension on the practice. When you were talking about task positive regulation, isn't that just a fancy way of saying focusing? I mean, because I find anything that I'm attentively doing, writing, if I'm doing writing, if I'm even washing the dishes, all that other stuff seems to fall away.
Yes, it is focusing, and the network itself is generally called the task positive network, and it's an actual neural network in the brain which can become more robust, which we can have become thicker, denser, more robust. And but it absolutely is focusing, and it's related to attention. Sort of these are all very interrelated, and they are discrete networks that are interconnected in different ways and connect some of the same areas of the brain, some different areas of the brain. And the interesting thing is that working with these five in particular and strengthening them with specific practices, with neurosomatic, with this deeply embodied approach to practice altogether, but then with other specific body-mind practices, it's not just 1 + 1 + 1 + 1 + 1 = 5, but it's more like it equals 25 or 105 or 1,000. You know, we get this powerful synergistic effect. And so, yes, very much focusing in your experience that when you focus on something like washing the dishes, if you really get into feeling, I love washing the dishes. I'm the dishwasher at our home. And at the sink, we have a window that looks out on a nice landscape in the Connecticut River. So I love washing the dishes, feeling the hot water and the suds on my hands. And the sense of accomplishment is I get a stack of dirty dishes clean. But also, you know, by really relaxing into it, my mind really quiets down. It's a very meditative thing to do, as you described. So. Absolutely.
May I ask a follow-up quick question?
Yes.
It is such a pleasurable and wonderful experience to get that focus and task regulated. And I really would like to write and do a lot more writing because that is a result that I experience when I do it. How do I get over my inertia to begin the task?
I think that might be the $64,000 question for a lot of us. I think it's helpful to step back for a moment, and doing some journaling around this can be very helpful. Like whatever it is, let's say it's writing. Why do I want to do that? What is it that I hope to create? What is the experience I hope to create? Why is that meaningful to me personally? And then are there some ways that it would benefit others? In other words, if our why gets big enough, and if our why is bigger than just our personal why is very important, but if we make it even bigger because we see this is going to benefit others, that'll generally cut through any other types of momentum that we have around inertia or procrastination and so forth. It's really getting clear about the why and making that bigger. And then, with any discipline, if we set ourselves up for success, we have a good place to do our writing, we have a set time of day that we do it, and we figure out what's the best time of day, what's the best place to do it. We set ourselves up for success in that way. We get really clear about our why, increase our motivation in that way. And then we'll find our way into the flow. And then, of course, there's the double reward system there, and we're really, benefiting from that. And then, of course, what we produce with writing, hopefully it does create benefit for ourselves and others. So, yeah, so that's hope that's helpful.
Thank you.
So, PB.
Hiya. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, hi. What's your first name?
Apple Bali.
Pobali?
Yes.
Okay. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Where are you from?
I live in London.
London. Uh-huh.
Yeah, but I'm Indian.
Uh-huh.
So I do a lot of shamatha practice.
Yeah.
Felt I mean I, yeah, so it felt quite like shamatha. Am I right in thinking that?
Yes, it's very much grounded in shamatha practice, calm abiding practice. It's intentionally structured to go deep into awareness, to really integrate shamatha and vipassana practice. But initially, attention stabilization is shamatha practice, and I think it's very foundational to our progress with practice.
Sure. Okay, I'm not going to ask the bigger question of when shamatha actually integrates towards vipassana, but generally I find that the more you listen to the wisdom of the body, rather than the body seems wiser than the mind. Like it's always giving us signals which we kind of tend to override with the mind, isn't it? I mean, that's what
Yes.
I'm thinking.
Right. So the body has a lot of wisdom. The body has innate wisdom. And I think connecting more with our body. So, our culture in general has become very disembodied. I have a friend who says in Western culture, our body's been relegated to the role of simply being brain taxis, something to carry around this supercomputer on our shoulders, right? So any way in which we become more embodied is really helpful for us. And there's a lot of wisdom in the body. But we're also connecting by being more embodied. We're connecting with the emotional body, which is another source of wisdom. And as we stabilize our attention with shamatha and calm abiding and deeply embodied approaches, and we have the intention around really a deep longing to know ourselves as deeply as we can and to awaken for our own benefit and for the benefit of all beings, then naturally within these deeper states of awareness and flow, where we're able to relax more, insight will naturally begin to arise. Wisdom will arise, and the insight, the vipassana quality, the clear seeing, the insight quality will very naturally arise. Unless we get attached to some experience, like if our whole purpose is just, I want to experience this deep focus, this deep flow concentration, and it feels so good, and that's what I want, I'm just going to, that can limit insight, right? So we want to always be a little aware of getting attached to anything in practice. We can feel profound states of flow and it can feel wonderful and blissful, but we don't want to be attached to that because it's really about creating the foundation for wisdom to arise. And it's the wisdom and insight itself that's ultimately going to liberate us from the roots of suffering.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Someone else? Questions, comments, your own experience, anything you'd like to share? One of my students in a session a week or two ago was talking about how through this deeply embodied practice, she never felt like she could be in communication with her organs before. But she finally suddenly found this awareness arising, and she was connecting with and getting information from different organ systems that was actually incredibly helpful. One was her thyroid, and she suffers from some thyroid issues and then different parts of the body. So she was getting this kind of intuitive wisdom from different parts of the body that helped her kind of discover, her pathway of healing for herself. So, the body is a tremendous source of wisdom and information. So we have Fanula. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, Fanula.
Yes, you are. Thank you. I was wondering how this relates to people who might be neurodivergent, or how it might be experienced by people who might be neurodivergent, and especially children. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about that, if
Is that
possible.
your experience, or you work with people who are neurodivergent, or?
Yes, I work with children who are neurodivergent, and I'm always mindful. I'm
Right.
always cautious as to how to proceed, or not, as the case may be. And
Right. Well, I think, with practice, we always want to approach practice with gentleness, with without any ambition whatsoever, with self-kindness, self-compassion, and gentleness. Gentleness is really the key. And there's really no expectations. And, even if someone, for whatever reason, is described as having a neurodivergent experience, it's still the whole body mind, right? It's all consciousness. It's all body and mind. It's all consciousness. And so, there's a pathway for anyone into greater awareness, attention stabilization, embodiment, flow, for anyone. And I think we need to respect that different people will have unique pathways and different approaches or subtle differences and nuanced differences in the approach to practice and techniques and how it's done. And it's going to be different for everyone. And so I think just being very gentle and accommodating, but also I think just wherever anyone is, just any way we can subtly invite ourselves and others into awareness, even just appreciating a flower blooming in the spring, or a breeze that comes up, or something related to music or sound, anything, could be anything, but just any way in which we invite awareness and embodiment, I think is going to be very helpful. And I think a lot of the work that's been most successful with people that we now call neurodivergent, and certainly I'm more familiar with work that's been done with people that were described as autistic, has a lot to do with embodiment and awareness. But, I think whoever we're working with, if we really drop into deep states of acceptance and flow and mindfulness awareness within ourselves, then from that place we can allow others to teach us how to support them. They will teach us how to support them. And they may teach us things about ourselves in the process. I don't know if that resonates with you or you find that helpful, but.
it does indeed resonate. I think it's the gentleness, and then being taught by children is always wonderful.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Thank you. George, can you give me permission to share? Or maybe I already have permission to share. I don't know. Let's see if I do now. Yeah. So I just wanted to give people a visual on this summit that I was talking about. So you can see there some very well-known meditation teachers like Jon Kabat-Zinn and Sharon Salzberg, Ruth King, Kristen Neff, Deepak Chopra, Mingyur Rinpoche, Rick Hansen, Pat Encke O'Hara from the New York Village Zendo, and Michael Beckwith, and so forth. And, Pulump Rinpoche and Rhonda McGee and Dzogchen Khonsa Rinpoche and Trudy Goodman and Sokhne Rinpoche and Sister Panawati and the famous kirtan singer Krishnadas and Elizabeth Mattis, Namiel, and so many others. And as you go down, I don't know how many speakers we have altogether, but there's a lot, like something like 65 now. And they're across all these different traditions. If you see the schedule down here, the first day is Vipassana with those teachers, including Joseph Goldstein, Sylvia Boorstein, incredible teachers. Zen, Norman Fisher, I mentioned Patty and Carol Hare, many others, Genpo Roshi, Kyra Jewel Lingo, Tibetan Vajrayana with four Tibetan lamas and other Western lamas and teachers, Robert Thurman, the Indian traditions, I mentioned Tony Nader, who's the global head of TM and the Dharma heir of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, Krishnadas, Debra Poneman, Mandarpa. We just recently added Sister Dr. Jenna. She's amazing. The Abrahamic traditions, with Sufi, Christian, and Jewish teachers, as well as Michael Beckwith from the New Thought tradition, non-dual teachers like A.H. Almas and Craig Hamilton, Locke Kelly, Amodah Ma. We just recently added Rupert Spira. The secular mindfulness tradition, as you recognize many of these teachers, I'm sure. And then neuroscience informed and so forth. Amazing folks like Larry Ward, Judd Brewer, and Dave Bogo, researcher Sarah Lazar from Harvard, another researcher, Richie Davidson from UW. So, anyway, I just wanted to give people a visual on that because I encourage us all to become students of the art of meditation. And I think it is helpful to find a tradition or a lineage that feels, instinctually very compatible for us, and maybe the body is the one that will really help us find our, the wisdom of the body may help us identify that, and to go really deep, to go as deep as we can in a particular tradition, but at the same time study everything else, not at the expense of that. And I think if we're just study everything else and we're just mixing and matching, we can end up staying on the surface a little too much. So I think it's important to go deep in a tradition, while at the same time being curious about all the other amazing technologies of illumination and contemplative wisdom and meditation throughout the planet, past, present, and future, across all cultures. So that's just what, it's kind of my bent. I encourage it in others, and that's what the summit is all about. So I think it could be a wonderful resource for you, and I hope you, if you decide to do that, I hope you enjoy it. So I think we're pretty much at the end of our time. Is that right, George?
We are. There's just a question here. Charles Rubin is asking if the summit will be available by video later for those who cannot attend during the 8 days seminar.
Yeah, it won't be available for free then, but it will be available for purchase, lifetime access, and it's incredibly inexpensive, especially the very first time you go there. When you first register, you'll get an offer that's incredibly inexpensive for what it is. And even if you wait later on, it's, in my view, it's still incredibly inexpensive for everything that's there. So you can purchase lifetime access and enjoy it as much as you like, whenever you like, for a long time. Yeah. And when you purchase lifetime access, you're investing with us because that's what pays the bills and supports the team of 17 wonderful human beings we have that build these incredible summits and that reach millions of people around the world for free. But it's still, this stuff just doesn't fall out of the sky. We work very hard to create it. And so when you purchase lifetime access, you invest with us. You invest in yourself and invest with us and help us keep putting on summits like this. So yeah. We have another one coming up in May called Rewiring Fear and Anxiety, which seems very helpful in terms of what a lot of us are experiencing in the world today. So we do a lot of, most of our summits are kind of in the body, mind, healing and life optimization and so forth, spiritual journeys. So thank you very much. Thank you, George, for facilitating, and thank you and Martin for inviting me and to again participate with Sangha Live. And I look forward to future opportunities to be with this community. And thank you all very much for showing up today, and thank you for your good practice. And along with everything else I shared today, I would just like to remind us that I think it's always helpful anytime we sit down to do formal practice to get clear about our motivation, which can be, I'm really working on today on healing or stabilizing, or I'm trying to lower my stress, or I'm just trying to awaken, or healing or what, and but then also having realizing that I'm also practicing for all sentient beings, that I'm practicing to liberate all beings, and that increasing that having that vast motivation, to really have a sense of all beings in all dimensions throughout every form, seen and unseen, all those beings and all the suffering and the possibility of appreciating the potential liberation and happiness of all beings. Our mind has to get very vast to take all that in and to have that vast aspiration. And that in and of itself really supports our practice of liberating the mind. So I just encourage us to work with that kind of vast motivation in our practice.